Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's visit today to Orlando, Florida, the site of the recent worst mass shooting in U.S. history, and speak with David Shanza, the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, who was previously the Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security. He joins us to discuss the gaps in the post-9/11 intelligence reforms that created the Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. We will examine the difficulty in policing the thoughts of potential terrorists before they act on them and cause mayhem, and assess what can be done to improve our broken immigration system so that potential terrorists can be screened out without scapegoating and surveilling communities and resorting to racial profiling. Then we'll get an update on the latest polls in the UK for the June 23rd vote on the so-called Brexit that indicate the Leave vote is at 51%, while the Remain vote is at 49%. William Walker, a professor of international relations at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, joins us to discuss the pernicious role of Rupert Murdoch in tipping the scales for the Leave vote and how a narrow victory for Leave could lead to political paralysis and the likely overturning of the vote by a majority of younger voters in the next few years. We'll also look into the feckless performance of the new Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who is hardly displaying a profile in courage. Then finally, we'll go to Moscow to speak with Nina Kusheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We will discuss Putin's bromance with Donald Trump, the Russian reaction to the deployment of NATO brigades in Poland and the Baltics, and the unholy trinity ruling Russia today: Putin's KGB cronies, the Siloviki in the Kremlin, the reactionary Orthodox Church hierarchy, and oligarchs currying favor with Putin while exploiting a mafia economy. And joining us now is David Shanza, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Stanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was a Democratic staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as the legislative director for Senator Jean Carnahan, counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and counsel to Senator William Cohen. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanza.
Happy to be with you.
And President Obama is in Orlando, Florida today, the site of the worst mass shooting in American history. And, of course, since the massacre at the nightclub in Orlando that killed 49 and wounded 53, and some of those people are in grave condition, there have been some recriminations about the FBI having interviewed this shooter a couple of times. And in general, I was hoping we could discuss some of the gaps in the post-9/11 intelligence reforms that created the Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Let's begin with the FBI. The FBI is largely a law enforcement agency, not an intelligence agency. In other words, they deal with crimes after they've been committed as opposed to before they've been committed. I know they did have a counterintelligence operation throughout the Cold War targeted at Russian spies here in the United States. But so is there a problem with that culture of law enforcement inside the FBI, or have they evolved since 9/11?
I think they really have evolved. The prior director, Director Mueller, made a lot of reforms with the FBI. And they became very dedicated to the question of prevention, not just arrest after the fact. I think what I'd like to say, you know, start off our conversation, there's really nothing easier than taking an incident and then moving backwards and pointing out, oh, this should have been found out, or we should have known that, rather than looking at the way the FBI has to look at it, which is that they're getting thousands of tips, point to people who individuals think are suspicious, and they're responsible for separating the wheat from the chaff, and doing that over and over again, and trying to pick out of these different thousands of pieces of evidence or information that they get, how many of these individuals are real cases and how many are not and don't deserve or warrant law enforcement resources. And I think they make the right call a very, very high percentage of the time, but it's an endeavor done by humans, so perfection isn't possible. They'll look over and over again, obviously, at this particular case. But I think when we talk about it, we have to understand the perspective that the real FBI is having to deal with, not the one we might fantasize about that can perfectly predict the future.
Well, of course, there is no algorithm to predict the future, is there? And one would think that, I mean, I think a lot of the evidence that's been presented, a lot of people suggest that, well, if a bunch of people said this guy was making terrorist threats, if his previous wife said he was violent, etc., how come the dots were not connected? But essentially, doesn't it get down to this problem that you cannot police people's thoughts?
Well, sure. If you want to live in a democracy and you want to have freedom, you don't want your most powerful law enforcement agency essentially being the thought police and saying, well, if somebody is saying something that is politically controversial, that's a reason to bring law enforcement resources to bear against them. What happened during the 60s and 70s is that people who were against the Vietnam War, for example, their loyalty was questioned, and the FBI was opening criminal investigations on people simply because of their political views. So we put restraints in place to prevent the FBI from opening or getting the right to do wiretaps or surveillance or opening criminal investigations explicitly just because somebody was exercising their First Amendment rights. So people do have a First Amendment right to say things that are anti-Semitic, that are homophobic, that protest U.S. foreign policy. You have a right to believe that, for example, the West is at war with Islam. When the FBI should open investigation is when there's, these kinds of comments that are connected with some level of conduct that shows that the individual may have connections with terrorist organizations or that they may be taking actions in preparation of violence. And that kind of evidence is harder to come by. So, I just have a lot of respect for how challenging this particular problem is with homegrown terrorism, because these individuals generally aren't leaving a lot of clues and footprints.
And of course, the French have a lot more laxed ability to do surveillance and wiretaps. It doesn't require the kind of a FISA court process that the U.S. has, and it's pretty instantaneous. The police can put a lot of people under surveillance and wiretap them. And the terrorist a couple of days ago who killed the two police officers was under surveillance and wiretapped, and still they weren't able to prevent that. So nobody's saying that any of this is easy. But I guess with Hillary Clinton talking about how she's going to go after lone wolves, how do you deal with that threshold where a person sitting in a basement on the computer all day long, looking at all kinds of weird websites and, and maybe he's a loner and a loser, suddenly then turns into an assassin? How is that threshold detectable?
Yeah, it's tough. Sometimes it's not. And sometimes these folks do make their intentions known, and that's why a lot of them are caught. I mean, if you look over the past, it's almost 15 years, there have been a lot of potential individuals who have been stopped before they've engaged in violence. So, of course, we'd like perfection, and we focus on the horrific events that occur when we don't. But that said, sometimes they do make their intentions pretty well known through social media, on the internet. But what the research shows is that the people who generally have a sense that an individual is radicalizing, that they're beginning to not only take on a you know, a heightened politicization of their identity, but also possibly moving towards a violence, taking action in furtherance of those beliefs. And that's the, you know, that's when they cross that threshold. That's when you want an intervention. That it's friends and family who are going to be most sensitive and most able to see that. So the goal here is to really create an education and an environment such that it would be that's conducive to getting those people who might get that information to come forward. And I think that's the environment, and those we need to have policies to put create that environment and promote it. And I think a lot of what we're seeing in some of the political rhetoric, especially from Mr. Trump, is creating fear, bigotry, scapegoating. And that's just the kind of environment that is going to make people more hesitant, I think.
Well, you could make the case that the Islamic community in the United States is America's first line of defense against this kind of terrorism, because they're the very people that are most likely to notice the aberrations of, say, these young men like the fellow in Orlando and San Bernardino and earlier in Tennessee. So, of course, by scapegoating, surveilling, and racial profiling, which is pretty much what Trump is suggesting, along with banning Muslims altogether from this country, that is not likely to have America's Muslim communities want to cooperate with law enforcement authorities. I mean, it's so counterintuitive. It's pretty disgraceful, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, let me say one thing, though. I truly believe that the vast majority of Muslim Americans faced, and all Americans faced, when they actually have real evidence that somebody's going to, you know, commit this horrific act of violence, we're going to see about his second wife, what she knew. But, you know, Muslim or non-Muslim, I think they're going to come forward. But what we're really looking for is, you know, a little bit earlier of a warning sign that somebody is even considering this. You know, you don't want to have to intercept somebody on their way to the attack. And in some ways, that's almost like a little bit earlier. That's more of like a predictive judgment that the friends and family, that, hey, this person is in trouble. This person might be trouble to others because they're moving towards violence. And that's when you really need to have this more, you know, you have to have this trusting environment between the community, the police, individual, that, you know, people would feel, you know, comfortable that if they came forward, that wouldn't mean that their whole community would come under suspicion. You know, if you have somebody like Mr. Trump, who's actually in charge of the government, I think that people will be more reticent to come forward because they would fear that the whole force of the federal government would come down upon them and everybody that they knew, and the aspersion would be cast upon all these people, and their lives, you know, could potentially be ruined. And if you don't have that, if you have that kind of atmosphere, you're never going to get the kind of cooperation we need to do the very hard job of preventing, you know, these kinds of difficult to detect acts.
But of course, the problem is that Donald Trump's demagogic rhetoric is resonating, that a lot of Americans do see our immigration system as being broken, and they do see a certain pattern here repeating itself over and over again. And you could make the case that there's a kind of odd and rather sick symbiosis between Trump and the Islamic State. The more of these attacks that take place here, the more he goes up in the polls. So, and he rather shamelessly exploited the Orlando massacre. So, you know, my sense is that some of these problems with immigration, I know it's a part of Homeland Security, but, you know, the Sonara brothers came in on a political asylum visa. The young woman in San Bernardino came in on a marriage visa. Is there any, are these gaps, or are these just, you know, how do you explain these gaps? Because I think the average American is feeling like the net is pretty porous.
Yeah, well, the Sarnaevs came into the country when they were young boys. So, I mean, what they took, there's nothing in the immigration system that would have, you know, screened them for something that they were going to do 10, 15 years later. It was the experiences that they had in America and that, you know, some of the attitudes they took on while here that led to their event. A little bit different with, I think, the San Bernardino shooter. I'm still really learning a lot about her. You know, I guess I just don't know what to say about that, in that there is no perfect screening process that you can know. And, of course, we, you know, are subjected to a lot of violence from neighbors. Look at the number of murders that take place in the New York Times article a couple of weeks, horrifying, about a Memorial Day weekend. And I can't remember if it was 50 or 60 people were shot and 9 people were killed. So the violence comes from a lot of different sources. And I don't think our immigration system counts for a disproportionate amount of it.
No, and in fact, there's obviously a similarity between the kind of violence that takes place with American homegrown loners, disturbed people like the shooter in the Colorado Theater or the Planned Parenthood clinic, et cetera. There is a similarity with the shooter, for example, down in Orlando. And I guess the one thing you can say that is glaringly obvious, which is that these kind of people should not have access to military-style weapons.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think, you know, it remains to be seen if the tide is turning on this particular issue. It seems that Mr. Trump is having some conversations with the NRA about its position on, you know, individuals who are on terrorist watch lists getting access to firearms. There just doesn't seem to be any logic that if somebody is under sufficient suspicion that we don't think they should be allowed to board a plane, that we think that, you know, they're a threat to hijacking, I guess, the plane, or engaging in violence while they're, you know, on the plane, that person is not also too much of a threat to own the kind of weaponry that can kill so many people in such a short amount of time. To me, it boggles the mind. I don't know what the argument against that particular proposal could possibly be. And when it comes to, you know, what we were talking about earlier with the FBI, you know, I'd really like to see a situation where somebody that they've investigated in the past, that if they get information that they've bought a long-arm weapon or a semi-automatic assault-style weapon, that investigation should be reopened, because that's just the evidence that they might have not had before, that an individual who has radicalized views is now moving to taking violence to perpetuate, to further those views.
Well, of course, the NRA have crippled the ATF, who would normally share that information. But
Ian, we knew within hours after the shooter's name was revealed, the ATF was reporting, right, you know, where he had bought those firearms and what the right weaponry was. So the information exists within the federal government. The process of passing it on to the FBI and then comparing it to, you know, it might be a large list, but it's a finite list in the age of computers. It's very doable. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that would be even more effective than preventing them from buying certain guns, because that would actually, you know, give them an insight into somebody moving towards violence that they could go and arrest.
Well, David Chancellor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, I enjoyed chatting with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with David Chancellor, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an update on the latest polls in the UK for the June 23rd Brexit vote.
Man, see that we are brothers, not 'cause things the same, because we lack the same color, and that's gray. Now that's May, can't burn his cross, 'cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running give you the jitters, just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
And it says here, we should be proud that we are free, and our free press reflects our democracy. Those praying voices on the right of the house are echoed down the street of shame, where politics mix with bingo and tits in a money and numbers game, where they offer you a feature on stockings and suspenders next to a call for stiffer penalties.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Scotland is William Walker, who's a professor of international relations at the University of St Andrews in Scotland. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Walker.
Thank you, yes.
And last time we spoke, of course, was when Scottish independence was, there was a referendum on Scottish independence, and lo and behold, here we have another referendum, which is, in fact, a self-inflicted political wound that David Cameron is responsible for. There's a lot of problems in the world, enough problems without having to invent them, but lo and behold, here is this nightmare that Cameron's got himself into, and his own Conservative Party is split over the Brexit, and the latest polls are pretty chilling. There's a 2-point lead for the Leave over the Remain, and with 10% undecided. What's your sense there in the UK at the moment, William Walker, of how this thing might turn out on June the 23rd?
Well, as you say, just recently there has been a big movement towards the supporting Brexit, and the that campaign. One thing that's happened in Scotland, by the way, is that the independents, when the Scottish National Party first had the idea of the referendum, they didn't really expect to win it. But what they found as they got into the whole process of the run-up to the referendum and all the political activism went on, it actually turned into a political movement, sort of from ground up almost. And I think this is actually what's happening here to some extent, is in fact it's becoming a movement that's not just directed from above from politicians and journalists, and some journalists who've always wanted this, but actually there's a ground-based movement of people who are very passionately, I think wrongly myself, but very passionately believing, in fact, that England in particular, its future is better outside the European Union. And once it acquires this kind of momentum, it's very hard to reason with it. I mean, people become very emotional and very bound up with the idea of actually and excited by the idea of leaving Europe, and some promised land is going to be reached in which, you know, Britain is going to become, you know, itself again. And one of the phrases used quite frequently now, and it's very hard to argue against, is people say, we want our country back. Now, what on earth does that mean? But nevertheless, it has a very nostalgic ring to it, and particularly among an older generation. So I think that the Remain campaign, as they call it, actually is in a bit of a difficult position now, because they're finding it very hard to persuade people to really think about this and think about the implications of it. And at the moment, they're rather at sixes and sevens, and I have to say, beginning to panic a bit. Now, I think, you know, it's still a week to go, and it could be, in fact, that the Leave campaign is at a bit of a peak, and when people really begin thinking about the implications of this a bit more and worried about jobs and everything else, and they may find, you know, that the Remain campaign, as it's called, people who want to remain in the European Union, begins to recover some ground. I think that what's going to happen is it's going to be very, very close. And my nightmare, and I think many people's nightmare, is in fact you get a very narrow vote in favor of leaving the European Union. So say 51% leave and 49% remain. And there, I think you have a political crisis of a great magnitude, actually, because we're going to find that Mr. Cameron would have to resign. Mr. Johnson, who's led the Leave campaign, is so unpopular within his own party. He has great enemies. He won't, I don't think, become the leader. And so you're going to find a Conservative Party that is really at war with itself, a Labour Party that is also at sixes and sevens, and then the majority of people in the Parliament in London who actually don't want to leave Europe. And so you have this popular vote for all sorts of reasons, and the immigration thing has been the big issue, actually. Popular vote for leaving, but without really having enough political clout behind it to really push through with the next stage, which would be actually, you know, severing ties with the European Union, which is an enormous thing to do.
So what role, then, William Walker, has Rupert Murdoch's newspapers played? His tabloid, The Sun, which he apparently has editorial control over, in effect writes the editorials. On Tuesday, they came up with a front page cover saying, Believe in Britain, and it was B-E, and then in caps, L-E-A-V-E, in the Union Jack motif.
That's correct, yeah.
So how much is Murdoch putting his finger on the scales and tipping it for the Leave campaign?
Well, he has been, he has regarded the European Union, I mean, this may be using the wrong kind of language, but as his enemy for a very long time. And his papers and one or two others, right-wing papers, but ones with very big circulation, it's been drip, drip, drip over years and years and years, actually almost ever since Britain joined the European communities and then union, anti-European, about portraying Brussels as being this vast bureaucracy taking over the country, et cetera, et cetera. What he hates is regulation. His media empire, he obviously wants freedom to expand it in every way he possibly can. And he doesn't want to be regulated. And so he regards Brussels as being potentially, you know, this place that, in fact, he would constrain him. There may also be an element of being an Australian and, you know, outside the European Union and coming from the outside and just disliking continental Europeans. I don't know really what fires him up. But I think it's very much in terms of his commercial interest and his megalomania, you might say, in trying to dominate the media, not only in this country but elsewhere. Now, in terms of its effect now, it's hard to judge because clearly it does have some effect. But on the other hand, you don't want to exaggerate. And one thing that happened in the Scottish referendum is, in fact, the media appeared to have very little influence at all in the outcome. And on the other hand, the media in that case was pro-maintaining the union. So it was sort of on the conservative side. In this case, the media is on the side of the political movement that wants to actually make the change, if you get me.
Right.
So I think it is a significant thing, and The Sun has a very big readership, and it's playing on these anxieties and fears about immigration in a very big way. I have to say, from my point of view, in a rather nasty way, I think it clearly is having some effect, but I'm not sure you should exaggerate it, because this has been going on for a very, very long time. And there's so many other ways in which people are influenced these days through the social media and so on. It's really hard to judge how much influence Murdoch does have in this kind of rather frenzied atmosphere.
Well, indeed. And, of course, social media is often associated with younger voters who,
yeah,
that is more their milieu. But on the other hand, it's also been established that young voters are pretty apathetic. And Barack Obama, President of the United States, went over to the UK recently to fire up the young people, to get them to vote,
yeah,
for the Remain in the Brexit. So, again,
it seems there was a flood of people trying to register towards the very last moment.
Uh-huh.
Young people in particular, but there was difficulty over the technicalities of that. But you're right, and in fact, one of the disconcerting aspects of this referendum is that it seems that the older generation, say the 60-plus, are much more likely to vote, for reasons I find difficult to understand, to leave the European Union than the young. And if you do get a very close vote, so as I say, if it's a 51-49, you'll find, in fact, that the younger generation, who really want to stay part of Europe and are very internationalist, find themselves outvoted by an older generation. into making this enormous change of coming out of the European Union. And I think that is in itself a bit of a crisis. You know, I think it's really a very uncomfortable place to be. And just to point out, too, is I think you're going to find, if it's very close vote, there's going to be a great attention to which parts of the UK voted how. And you're going to find, I think, it's not really very clear, but in Scotland, Northern Ireland, perhaps Wales, perhaps London, bits of London, you're going to find rather strong votes for staying in, and other parts of Britain are going to be for moving out. And in the sort of internal politics of the UK, that's going to be very significant too. And certainly in Scotland, there is a view, I'm not sure it's going to come to this, that if Scotland votes strongly, yes, we want to stay in, and the rest of the UK says, no, we're getting out, and then Scotland finds itself being dragged out of the Union, then that's going to raise the whole independence issue again. I think it's the politicians up here in Scotland, where I live, are cautious about this, because one thing that's happened is the collapse of the oil price means the Scottish economy is being hit pretty hard at the moment. And so it's not really a good time to be thinking about independence and all the risks associated with independence. On the other hand, if it seems that England is, and particularly southern England, is dragging Scotland out of the European Union, when in fact Scotland feels really rather attached to the idea of being part of the Union, then again, it's where this goes, I don't know. It becomes very complicated, the politics of it all.
Tell me, though, about the role of, we've talked about how Cameron brought this on himself. This is a completely self-inflicted political wound and an unnecessary crisis, of a manufactured crisis, which now could turn into a nightmare. And, of course, it's got people over here worried. The chairman of the Fed is concerned, that she pointed out the other day, that there could be a contagion on the markets, with the markets crashing in Europe and then affecting Wall Street. But let's talk about the role of the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn. My understanding is that he's behaving in a way, he's trying to sit on the fence. And in this moment of really serious crisis, as you have made clear, he's not coming across as a profile in courage at all. He's coming across being pretty craven and not really standing up and educating Labour Party voters about what's really happening here. And, you know, he's sort of, half of me is pandering to the worst kind of reactionary instincts in the working class, and in this whole nostalgia that you point out that is unreal, you know, going recreating the empire almost. Give me your take on Corbyn, because he's been thought of over here, particularly by the American left, as some kind of new hero, but at this point he doesn't look particularly good.
I think he has his own, I think from way back he's been a skeptic and actually an opponent to the idea of Britain being part of the European Union, going way back. I think that's a bit of his history. But, I mean, he may have changed his attitude to all that, but I think he's facing a situation where his party is divided. And he doesn't know how to play it, in that he knows that within the party there are some wings to it, and particularly people down on the ground level who are very opposed to the European Union. And I suppose I'm not close to him, so I don't know. But I suppose he's hoped that he could sort of float above this and stand back and not draw a tremendous amount of attention to his role in this, and could allow other people to make the running. But he finds himself now really in a very difficult position, because this is great anxiety that many Labour voters are actually going to vote to leave the European Union. And a substantial wing of his party, particularly the New Labour and the people who ran it for the last 10, 20 years, Gordon Brown and all the rest of them, passionately feel that Britain has to stay in the European Union. And so late in the day, he's under great pressure to speak strongly in favor of it, but he hasn't really prepared his ground for it. And when he speaks about it, he's not a good speaker anyway. He's not charismatic. And when he speaks about it, it comes over as being a bit feeble. And so, in fact, other people in the party are having to try to to take it up and to run with it, but it's very late in the day. So if you do get a situation where, you know, you get this very narrow vote or something like that for leaving the European Union, not only do you have a crisis in the Conservative Party, but I think you have a crisis in the Labour Party too. And to throw in one other thing that's happening is, I mean, just today, you had the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, making this claim that, in fact, if you do leave Europe, you're going to have a financial crisis, I'm going to have to raise taxes, you're going to have to, you know, there's all sorts of terrible things are going to happen, it's going to hit your pocket. I think this is partly, you know, panic on his side, but also I think he sincerely believes, in fact, there's a grave financial risk here, and people are going to be hurt economically. And then immediately 50 or 60 Conservative members of Parliament who favour leaving Europe are saying, if you try and do that, we will not vote for you, we will oppose it. So what you could have is, in fact, the Chancellor of the Exchequer the day after, or week after, or 2 weeks after, or something like that, has an emergency budget. And it's defeated in the House of Commons. Mm. And what happens? You know, and it's quite easy to create a scenario in which all of this leads to complete confusion and crisis and God knows what else in the House of Parliament. And very soon you actually have a general election. At the same time, you have a completely divided Conservative Party, a completely divided Labour Party, and neither of them have really got clear leadership. So what happens, you know? And, you know, it doesn't bear much thinking. I mean, I have to say, the whole thing could become a terrible nightmare. And quite a lot of people begin to think that this vote, if it is a narrow vote for exit, it's actually probably might be reversed in some way. And you find after a time you have a terrible period of God knows what happened. And somehow it doesn't happen.
Right. And, well, as you pointed out, the young people are against it, so and the old people are for it. So presumably, in a matter of time, the young people will assert themselves. I'm afraid we've run out of time, William Walker, but I thank you very much for joining us. It's been a very
pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with William Walker, who's a professor of international relations at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and he joined us from Edinburgh in Scotland. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Moscow to look into the bromance between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Moscow is Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And she has an article at Project Syndicate, Putin's Illusion of Reform. So there's a lot to talk about Russian soccer hooliganism. It looks like the British have been replaced as the world's most notorious soccer hooligans. NATO battalions now moving into the Baltics. And your article, Putin's Illusion of Reform, gives us a flavor of what Russia's like today since you're there. So let's begin with that. There seems to be a disconnect. On the one hand, the economy appears to be tanking, and there's a scarcity of goods, etc. And on the other hand, I take it that Putin's popularity is something over 80%. So explain that, if you will.
Well, thank you, Ian. There's a clearly, it's not about the economy. I mean, as we said, it's the economy stupid. It's actually the other way around in the Russian case. He's popular, Putin is popular and has been popular despite the fact the economy is tanking, because what Russia takes more seriously, or many Russians take more seriously than their own well-being, is the well-being of the state. And that's how the well-being of their life is presented. And it's not about them, you know, being fed or having pensions paid, but it's more than the West is not going to take us over. They're not going to invade us. We're going to stand up to them. You just mentioned the hooliganism between the Russians and the British, those soccer fans. We're going to stand up to them. And that's more important. It has always been more important for the Russians than their economic well-being. That's why Russian economy has, most of the time, most of its history has been a military-industrial economy rather than the consumer economy, and that's what Putin is banking on.
So is this a form of military Keynesianism, or is this just a tradition and a priority? Because obviously building up the military has been clearly a major project of Putin's, and I believe he's had some success. So, I mean, from what you're telling us, it would seem that deploying a few battalions in the Baltics on the part of NATO would play right into the strategy of, or Putin would be able to spin that in such a way to say, see, you know, we need to stand up to them. They're encroaching on us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he has already spun it. And basically, he kept saying the West is out to get us for quite some time. And now with NATO, all countries sort of taking, some go to Poland, some go to some go to Estonia, some go to Latvia, some stay in Lithuania. Of course, it's been spinning insanely here. That's what I told you. It started with George Bush's new project on Star Wars or whatever. I keep forgetting the English name for it. The
Strategic Defense
shield
Initiative. Yeah.
The defense missile shield that that Bush was saying was against Iran. And Putin already then, in mid 2000s, was saying no, it's against Russia. And now 10 years. I mean, the man has patience. And 10 years later, he says, "Well, I told you that they're going to get us, and here they are, and they're so we have the right to increase our military because it is the matter of our sovereignty. It is the matter of our national security. It is the matter of our independence, and we're not going to be put on our knees." So, which is a very, very important message for the Russians. And, you know, they use the Second World War and Soviet fight, the Russian fight against the Nazis, as one of those examples, is that, you know, what Russia, yes, we starved, but we beat the fascists. And now the argument is of a very similar kind.
So I take it, though, and as your article points out, Nina Khrushcheva, that Putin really has not achieved very much, not in the way that Stalin, for example, defeated the Nazis. And in fact, he hasn't necessarily been good for the country because it's got a kind of a mafia economy, and his actions in Crimea, for whatever benefits that was, obviously huge propaganda benefits, but given the sanctions that were imposed as a result of it, and the standoff in Ukraine, where it seems like, you know, it's probably destroyed the economy, or at least damaged the economy of Ukraine, but it's also turned the Ukrainian people against him, against Russia, which is something that I don't think is entirely an historical condition. And I imagine the Poles and the Baltic states are also getting nervous. So there is a kind of action and reaction going on here, is there not?
Oh, absolutely. There is an action and reaction, but that's what Putin's mindset is. I mean, it is basically KGB. You know, we used to talk about the military dictatorships in Latin America and many other countries. I mean, it is a KGB military dictatorship or KGB dictatorship here. I mean, it's run, the country is run by a KGB junta that takes decisions based not on the country's development or necessity, but how much money then can make out of whatever businesses. I mean, I walk around Moscow in disbelief because every single street is under construction. You cannot really have every street in a city under construction. It's just not possible. But the mayor of Moscow is a man whose wife owns a brick business. And so every single street in Moscow is now covered with bricks because that's how they make their money. I mean, it's something absolutely inconceivable. And the project is from May to September, which means that the time when there are people coming and willing to come and visit, there's very great tourist season. It's not possible. You cannot enter a restaurant. I mean, so it's in some ways it's sort of this greatness and decay in one swoop, and that's sort of something absolutely remarkable about Moscow. And yes, and that's the contradiction of Russia, is that on one hand, he's increasing military-industrial complex, and you know they pretend to be a strong leader. On the other hand, how long this kind of sham of Putinism can last? Because you know it doesn't. As you started this conversation with, he really didn't build anything. Crimea is in disarray. All the promises that were made have not been met. I mean, Crimeans wanted to have another Sochi. They thought it would be the Olympic city, very well arranged, and it's not, not at all. And so, but I, you know, one of the things that is so remarkable, it has been Russian predicament for so many years, for so many decades, for so many centuries, that it's almost impossible to even say how bad it is, because it's always like that.
Right, but beyond this, the Siloviki, the coterie of ex-KGB people who sort of run the country, or at least sort of regulate the oligarchs, if that's how it is, as you point out in your article, let me just read from it. The explanation can be found, and I'm suggesting that beyond the Siloviki, there's this other unholy alliance. The explanation can be found in a billboard on the Lubalevsky Highway leading to Putin's country residence, which reads, "Russia is a force for peace, the last hope of God on earth. It's been paid for by a private firm to please the Kremlin," and the billboard highlights Putin's alliance with the ultra-conservative Russian Orthodox Church, enabling him to fuse religious faith, patriotism, and blind trust in the state. This, together with private companies' eagerness to curry favor, forms the foundation of Putin's leadership. So that's the unholy trinity then, right?
It is, absolutely. It is the KGB, and it's the state, and it's the blind faith, and it's once again, I mean, now it's the Christian orthodoxy, and before it was communist, but, you know, it goes to an absolute extreme. And, for example, I was passing by a cathedral, and a man came up to me and started screaming at me, and I sort of was startled completely, and he said, "You have to cross yourself." And I said, "No, but I don't." And that's the problem with the state, that suddenly everybody gets involved into how the state is run. So if Putin himself doesn't look after everybody to act the way he thinks a great patriot should act, there's all these other people randomly coming up to you and saying you should act a certain way. And if you are not acting this way, you by definition become an enemy. And, you know, that's something that we witnessed, in fact, in France with the soccer fans, is, you know, were they sent? Were they sent by the state? Were they sent by some Putin flunkies that thought that it was a great idea to make sure that the state is represented correctly, or was it whatever, just very enthusiastic volunteers who thought that every single flight towards Russia should be taken as an enemy act. And I think that's what that really makes it, that makes it such an explosive, such a remarkable and very dangerous combination. And when you put faith into, because people with faith are very blind to imperfections of the state, because if they believe the state is given by God, then the president, which is kind of an oxymoron in terms, becomes that kind of God, Putin the first, and then he can do no wrong, and everybody who says anything against him can do no right. And so that really becomes a weird, strange, junta capitalist religious fundamentalism state that Russia is today.
So let's talk a little bit about this bromance between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. And frankly, it's difficult not to predict that Trump will crash and burn. First of all, he, as Sid Blumenthal described him as the dog who caught the fire truck. He ran for president to improve his brand, and lo and behold, he's now the nominee of the Republican Party and probably doesn't want the job that he's running for. But nevertheless, he's the leader, and the rest of the party is squirming every time he opens his mouth. So it's a kind of surreal situation that we're in here, and I don't see Trump lasting, or if he does last to the end, I think he'll be absolutely humiliated at the polls. But on the other hand, you know, we live in this crazy world where there's a peculiar symbiosis between Trump and Daesh, the Islamic State. The more terrorist attacks like Orlando, the more Trump goes up in the polls. So he's had a very bad couple of weeks here, and then suddenly, because of a terrorist attack in Orlando, his numbers have gone up again. So that is a crazy symbiosis. But how is he portrayed in Russia, and what is the extent of this bromance between Putin and Trump?
Well, as you know, I mean, they've been complementing each other because in some ways they're very twin-like characters. They're brash, they say things that other people can never get away with. In fact, there have been a number of, you know, Russians are very, you know, once you have a state like that, which is a gangster state most of the time, you kind of have to have a sense of humor, otherwise you just have to commit suicide. And so there have been a lot of jokes and comparisons because, you know, when Trump goes after women or goes after Republicans or goes after the press or the Washington Post or whatever, he, I mean, basically everybody who comes across as somebody who or something that doesn't support him. Putin is in very similar in some ways. You may remember some years ago a journalist asked him a question about Chechnya, and he suggested that this journalist should go and try to have circumcision, and then he'll see how good it is and great it is. And then another time he was talking about the terrorists, and he said, we are going to kill them in the outhouse. So he's known for similar kind of running of his tongue. And yet they get away with it, and they get even more popular with it, because there's always this percentage of the population that think that, you know, we're going to look for a strong man who's going to save us from problems. And, of course, very few people actually think how they're going to do it. So, and Putin and Trump both know very well how to manipulate public opinion in this way. But I also think if, you know, Trump, God forbid, is going to be elected president, I don't think that bromance will last long, because can you imagine one is saying something, another one doesn't like it, and they're going to insult each other and go after each other. It's going to be worse than, you know, Donald Trump and Rosie O'Donnell. So that is kind of an interesting, it would be an interesting thing to watch, but I don't really see that bromance can last, because in some ways they're just way too similar to get along. Well, but for what it's worth, the Russians cannot stand Hillary Clinton. I mean, they're afraid of her in some ways, because also in Putin, as you know, he's not particularly favorable towards different genders or different sexual orientations or different races. He's very much of a kind of Russian Tsar type that only us, our type, matters. So, you know, that man, Putin, white man thing. And so they don't want Hillary Clinton, so of course they're going to put up Trump as much as they can. But what's interesting here is that on one hand, Trump is very popular. I think about 35% of the Russians think that Trump is a great president for the United States. We're going to have great relationship. They're not going to insult us anymore. So all good. Those others, part of the 35%, also support Trump as president, but from a very perverse kind of point of view. They keep saying, well, he's so embarrassing that America can, if Trump is president, America can no longer even pretend to be a superpower, because this is ridiculous. This is just not somebody who should. If America elects this man, America is a total idiot. And the third sort of school of thought is also very interesting. It's like, well, Americans keep lecturing us on how we love Putin, and he's 80%, something that our conversation started with, he's 80% of the popularity. Look at yourself. You idiots. You election Trump. So who are you? Get off your high horse, because as far as you people are concerned, you are no better than us. So it's kind of a very mixed conversation. I've been actually having various discussions about it. It's very, very interesting. Because Hillary Clinton, as she does for many in the United States, keep people rather cold and uninterested. And the minute you mention Donald Trump, they just go crazy.
Well, just in closing, Nina Khrushcheva, the other question I wanted to ask was about the Brexit, which it looks as though the Leave people might win in this June 23rd referendum in the UK. A totally self-inflicted wound by Prime Minister Cameron. There's enough problems in the world without creating new problems. But the assumption is that Vladimir Putin would be happy to see the British leave the EU and to see the EU unravel, which many people think it will be a consequence of Britain's exit.
I think so, too. I mean, he did say that he doesn't support the Brexit, but, you know, whatever he says and whatever he means is often two different things. So he says he doesn't support it, but I think, because he really functions, I mean, his incredible function in the world is a splinter. He really takes advantage of other weaknesses rather than building his own strength in out of something tangible. And so for him, I think Brexit will work well, because it's yet another kind of disarray in the European Union and in Europe. And we already have, even in the European Union, there's a lot of disarray, a lot of it around Putin and Russia. You know, you have all the supporters of Putin, such as Viktor Orban in Hungary and various politicians in the Czech Republic. And, you know, there's a question of Italy, where does Italy stand and whatnot. And so for him, that's just yet another country that that he can screw with his whatever policies are. And since the United States is the major enemy and England is the second enemy, this sort of if you have a list of enemies and, you know, 100%, 90% and whatnot, he would like to see England hurt. And I think the predictions that England would get hurt by Brexit probably would work well for him on many different levels, from psychological to economic to political.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you very much for joining us from Moscow. Much appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down to the right-hand side to sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.